It's from John chapter 20. This is the continuation. We've been doing a long series in little chunks right through John's gospel. And we're in the penultimate chapter, the empty tomb. And I'm going to read chapter 20, verses 1 to 10, which is on your screens. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." So Peter went out with the other disciple, and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there, and the face cloth which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. Great, we're going to look at that in a bit of detail, so do keep it open if you've got a Bible, or we'll share it as well on the screens. I'll try and share it on my screen at least with Prezi. Now, a book that we've been reading as a staff team is this one, Douglas Murray's The Madness of Crowds. We've just started it. And in the intro to this book, Murray, he writes this: "People in wealthy Western democracies today are the first people in recorded history to have absolutely no explanation for what we are doing here and no story to give life purpose. The question of what exactly are we meant to do now, other than get rich where we can and have whatever fun is on offer, needs answering," he says. And Murray describes in this book how current modern narratives are trying desperately to create a story to fill this vacuum. But these modern narratives just don't have sufficient foundations. They don't have sufficient stability to actually work and be livable. And really answer the big questions in life that we all have. Now, Murray's not the first person to point this out, this problem in our society of a lack of a story. Robert Jensen, the Princeton theologian, he wrote a seminal article back in 2010 called "How the World Lost Its Story." And he argues pretty much the same point. The biggest problem in our culture, he says, is the absence of a story. We once thought that life had a purpose. We once thought that there was something objective to live for. There was hope for a resolution to the sufferings in this world. But now it seems, he says, as though we are left adrift, without a story, without meaning, and without hope. So I want to ask you directly, how would you answer those questions this afternoon? Does life have a purpose? Is there anything ultimate to live for? Is there hope? In short, will the story of the world end well? And of course, 2020 has just intensified our need to answer these questions. Now, wonderfully, the event we're looking at today, the resurrection of Jesus, provides a wonderful and compelling answer to these questions. And the reason it does so is because the resurrection is not an isolated supernatural anomaly in the way things usually are. It's not just a blip. The resurrection of Jesus is the pivot to human history. It's the center point. It's the declaration that there is a story and that human history is not meaningless. It's the confirmation, as we're going to see in our final point today, that the story of the world will end well. James, I wonder if it might be good to spotlight my screen rather than Andrew's, just so that my headings are a bit bigger. I'll keep going. Before we look at what the resurrection means for us and for our world, the writer of this passage, the passage I just read in John, he wants us first to be clear that the resurrection really happened. So that's what we're going to spend most of the first half of the talk on. This question of Jesus really was raised. It's not just a suggestion, we can know it. So I'm going to go through in a bit of detail now the account that we just had read. It's an eyewitness account of what happened on that first Easter Sunday. So let me put up the text. It goes like this. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark. I'm guessing perhaps Mary hadn't slept that well. She thought, look, I'm wide awake now. Why don't I just head down to the tomb now? And when she got there, it says she saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Now, we read that and we think, well, we know what's coming. But for Mary, an empty tomb was not encouraging. It was just another twist of the knife. After everything that she's gone through these last 2 days, seeing Jesus crucified in front of her, everything she's gone through, can't they just leave Jesus alone? She's thinking. Verse 2, so she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. Actually, we discover in the next chapter that this is John. This is the writer of the gospel. And she said to Peter and to John, she said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we do not know where they have laid him. I love the use of the they there. You know, it's the same they who keep bringing in new laws, who keep digging up the roads. They have taken the Lord. And Peter and John assume they must be the grave robbers. They've probably taken the body. Grave robbers, I understand, were pretty common in those days because of the value of the cloths that they bound people in. Or perhaps it was the authorities that took the body. And so off they race, desperate to find out what has happened to their friend's body. And then the next bit, listening to the kind of incidental details which only an eyewitness would include. Verse 3, Peter went out with the other disciple. They were going towards the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. So we get this picture, don't we, of John, who's writing all this. He's hovering outside the tomb. He's waiting. He's waiting for his friend. And then he arrives and Peter comes breathless. And true to form, Peter just boldly strides straight in. Verse 6, then Simon Peter came. Let me go to the next slide. Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. And he sees something very significant. Peter saw the linen cloths lying there. And this is not at all what Peter was expecting. Why would whoever took this body have gone to all the trouble of unwrapping it, especially if it was, you know, grave robbers, because the cloth and the spices around the body were the precious bit. You wouldn't leave those behind. And then there's an even more curious thing than the fact that the clothes are still there in verse 7. If someone had ripped off the clothes, surely they'd be just strewn across the tomb. They would have done it in haste. But here they are, verse 7, neatly folded. It seems that someone, having unwrapped the body, which is a complicated task in itself, seems to have gone to the trouble of laying out the cloths to create an effect. And the question is, what is going on here? And actually, it is this detail which logically leads John to the answer of what has actually happened. Let's look at verse 8. Then the other disciple, John, who had reached the tomb first, also went in. And here's the moment. He saw and believed. It's a lovely moment. John is recording here the moment in his life when everything changed. It was a moment he never forgot. A bit like, you know, falling in love or the announcement of peace after war. You know, suddenly John knew that God was behind what was going on. This had God's fingerprints all over it. He knew, he believed. You see, John had trusted in Jesus before. He knew that Jesus was God's chosen one, but this was new. This was different. And he never forgot that crucial moment. And then John adds, verse 9, for as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. And John wants to reinforce here that he didn't fabricate a story to fit with his expectations. It was actually the opposite way around. Despite the predictions of the scriptures, despite Jesus' own predictions about his resurrection, none of the disciples understood, none of them were expecting what happened on that Sunday morning. Actually, in this chapter, Mary keeps asking the same question. Where have they put him? Where is he? It just doesn't occur to any of them that there could be any other explanation until they see the grave clothes and it finally dawns on John what has happened. And significantly here, the only thing that pushes John over the line, he tells us, was the bare facts, the reality of what he saw. And that is very significant. I think instinctively, I want to move quickly to the appearances of Jesus. Later in this chapter, there's some incredible episodes where Jesus appears bodily to his friends. He shows them his hands and his side, and he puts what John has just discovered at the tomb beyond any doubt. But John is saying here, yes, the appearances were amazing, that they confirmed everything. But don't forget the empty tomb. Don't forget those linen cloths. That on its own was enough to clinch it. If you think about it, the empty tomb is a very crucial part of this account. In fact, the appearances of Jesus without the empty tomb would be incomplete. There's something very stubborn, very unyielding about an empty tomb. There was a huge incentive, actually, for Jesus's opponents to reveal the dead body. Here it is. And then they would crush this strange new movement. But there was no body left to reveal. The empty tomb proclaims loudly and clearly that that body that went into that tomb is the same body, however transformed, that came walking out of the tomb, living and breathing. This isn't some airy-fairy spiritual kind of truth. This is hard, unyielding, undeniable reality. Jesus really was raised bodily. Now, I want to pause at this stage and just consider a couple of the reactions which we might be tempted to respond with. Sometimes people are dismissive of the resurrection because of certain cultural presuppositions. Perhaps we've bought into the worldview. I would say it's a faith position where we say that miracles just can't happen. And of course, the problem with this worldview is that it just closes us off to the evidence. Any evidence which doesn't already fit neatly into our existing worldview has to be thrown out. And so this worldview is very closed-minded and ironically very unscientific. And alongside that reaction, perhaps a more common reaction today is to say, well, let's not get hung up on whether this happened or not. I'm pleased for you if you're a Christian and, you know, this happens to give you comfort, but honestly, it's not my kind of thing. And respectfully, I don't think that this kind of response works either. In fact, I think it can be quite patronizing to the first Christians, by which I mean it can really be a failure to listen carefully to what they're actually saying on their own terms. You see, nearly all of the apostles went to their deaths because of this conviction that Jesus is alive. And many of the people they preached to, if they accepted the message, they would potentially follow on that same path. And none of them believed in Jesus' resurrection in some vague metaphorical sense, you know, as if it's just a nice idea. I don't think they would even have a category for that if we tried to explain it. For them, Jesus was either raised bodily or the whole thing was just a waste of time and they were to be pitied above all other people. So for us to impose this category, you know, saying what matters is some spiritual metaphor, not the historic events, that's actually a failure to listen carefully to what they're saying. Their claim is that this is like gravity. It's true, and therefore it's true for everyone. We can't just say, well, I'm not a gravity kind of person. It just doesn't make sense. And the reason it matters, of course, that Jesus really was raised is because this event changes everything. And specifically, it confirms, and this is what we're going to spend the rest of the time on, that the story of the world will end well. I mentioned that the linen cloths were very significant for Peter and John because the presence of the cloths showed that Jesus wasn't taken out of the tomb, but that he left the tomb of his own volition. He was alive. But as readers, we're meant to notice even more than that. And that's the reason we had our first reading from John 11, because these two incidents are meant to provide for us a kind of compare and contrast. They're both about dead people who come out of tombs. So it's a natural comparison. But then having noticed that similarity, nearly everything else about the two passages is very different. I wonder if you noticed that. When Jesus raised Lazarus, they had to roll the stone away. And then there's this kind of picture, isn't there, of Lazarus walking around like a mummy, you know, like at the end of Scooby-Doo. And Jesus has to command them to unbind him because he's just wrapped up in these grave clothes. And as soon as Lazarus comes out of the grave, we discover that the chief priest is so upset about Jesus doing this miracle and about Jesus' popularity that they make plans to try and kill Lazarus in chapter 12. So Lazarus' resurrection isn't a permanent fix at all. Yes, it's wonderful. Yes, Jesus has given him a few extra years. But Lazarus comes straight out into a world where death threats really matter. It's like, you may have seen this illustration before. It's as though death is a tunnel and Lazarus has gone into the tunnel when he died. And then Jesus calls him out of the tomb and he comes back out again for a few more years. But eventually, of course, Lazarus had to go into the tunnel again. And some people actually would have wept at his grave twice over. Double grief. Whereas it's so different at Jesus' grave. At Jesus' grave, the stone had somehow miraculously rolled away. One of the other gospel writers, Matthew, tells us it was an angel that did it. And the grave clothes were lying neatly folded. In fact, there's a strong indication that Jesus may have passed through his grave clothes, just as he appeared in locked rooms later in the chapter. And unlike Lazarus, who just gets a few extra years and is then under threat for his life, Jesus, by contrast, has devastated. He's utterly defeated death forever. Jesus has punched a hole through the tunnel, through death, into a whole new realm out the other side. Beyond this realm of decay, beyond this realm of disintegration, and he's seemingly beyond even the normal constraints of matter and space. He's gone into a new world where life, sheer life in all its fullness, can at last be experienced. And John wants to see us to see that what has happened here to Jesus isn't just an isolated incident for one person. Jesus' resurrection signals the beginning of a new world, a new creation. He is the first fruit. The rest is all on its way. Here's an illustration which might be nice for those keen crafters amongst us. I know there's a few people who like sewing and knitting. So it's as if Jesus is the needle who has pierced through the shroud of death. And then everyone who's threaded onto Jesus will get pulled through after him. He's the trailblazer, and now everything has changed for those who are connected to him. So it's not simply that Jesus has beaten death, although he has, but from the midst of this old and broken creation, he has launched a new creation, a new world. And John's actually the only one of the gospel writers who begins his gospel by placing Jesus' arrival on this earth in terms that make us think about the creation of the world. You may remember, in the beginning was the Word, chapter 1, verse 1. And as chapter 1 goes on, this Word, Jesus, brings life and he brings light into the world. You know, just like echoes of that first chapter of the Bible, Genesis 1, when God created the world. And in this chapter, chapter 20, John now gives us lots of hints that the resurrection in particular is the beginning of a new creation, a new world. The other Gospels are full of references to Jesus rising on the third day. So if you count inclusively, Good Friday, Easter Saturday, Easter Sunday, he was raised on the third day. That's how it's most often described, Easter Sunday, the third day. But John doesn't use that expression. John starts this chapter by telling us it was the first day of the week. This is the beginning of something. And unlike the other accounts, this chapter begins while it was still dark in verse 1. Just as Genesis 1 begins with darkness over the face of the deep. We're going to see even more clues as we go on in next week and the week after. But just a couple of spoilers. This chapter carries with it lots of references to the first two chapters of the Bible. So when Mary sees Jesus in verse 15, she imagines him to be the gardener, which reminds us of how the first human being, Adam, was a gardener. Jesus is a new Adam. And at the creation of human beings, the Bible tells us that God breathed into human nostrils the breath of life, Genesis 2 verse 7. And human beings became alive with God's life within them. And if we read on verse 22 of this chapter, the restoring life of God is breathed out through Jesus this time. He breathed on them, verse 22. And in doing so, Jesus makes the disciples into new people and through them offers life, new life to the world. So the point that's being made again and again is that the resurrection of Jesus is a new creation. It's the beginning of a new world. This is on a par in significance with the creation itself, the creation of the first world. This isn't just some isolated, quirky thing that once happened. Wow, that's weird. You know, a guy busted out of the grave somehow. No, this is the turning point of all history. This is the moment when supernaturally God broke in and he came into a fractured and sin-cursed world and he launched something new. Think about the significance of this. Previously, every life on this earth, every story, however impressive for a few years, they always ended the same way. In defeat, in futility, in the grave. But now God has broken into our story, and starting with the resurrection of Jesus, he has shown that there's a new story, a new trajectory, a new endpoint, not just for Jesus, but actually for the creation itself and for everyone who will become part of Jesus's new humanity. The creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay, as one writer puts it. So if you ask people what the biggest day of the year is for the Christian, I guess most people would say it's Christmas, and you know, we all love a romantic midwinter festival. We're all hoping the government don't cancel Christmas. But actually, if you ask the Bible what the big day is, the big turning point, I think the Bible's answer is Easter Sunday. This is the moment of the new creation. This is the first day of the new world. So it's because of Jesus' resurrection that we can be confident, and this is what I put in the heading, that the world will end well. I'm conscious that as a society, we're in profound need of hope right now. There's deep ecological fears. I'm going to think about that in big questions tonight. There's deep political fears, economic fears. There's deep health fears, especially at the moment. And as we were thinking about at the beginning, the current stories, the current narratives just don't offer us anything. The current attempts to find an explanatory story which makes sense of our world and gives answers to our deepest questions, they're just failing to deliver. And that is why the truth of Jesus' resurrection and what it means for our world is needed more than ever. We have good news for everyone in the world. And as we close, I just want us to think about two practical differences that belief in Jesus' resurrection can make in our lives. They're both from earlier in John's gospel. John has front-loaded lots of teaching about life when Jesus has gone, back in chapters 13 to 17. And now, after the resurrection, all of that teaching is now enabled and empowered. And I'll put there, well, first we can live sacrificially, and then finally we'll think about how we can live hopefully. But first, we can live sacrificially. Now, in our lengthy series through John's gospel, one of the key things that Jesus calls his disciples to is service. He calls us to serve one another. In chapter 13, Jesus washes his disciples' feet and then he says, now off you go and do likewise, wash one another's feet. But of course, it's not until after the resurrection that they're then ready, they're then empowered to do this. And part of the reason is that it's the resurrection which empowers us to live sacrificially. There's a brilliant example of how this dynamic works from back in Christian history, well, in the Roman Empire. This is actually very topical. Back in the second and third centuries, there was a pandemic. There was a plague, and it was a series of plagues, really. And in the course of about 100 years, about 25 to 35% of the population of the empire was wiped out. And because these plagues were so contagious, what happened? Well, the rich just left the cities in droves, including the medics. And very often they left their own family members behind if they'd got sick. And the strange thing was that the Christians stayed. And the Christians cared not only for their own sick, but also for those who had been abandoned. And this is documented in lots and lots of places. And as a result, many of the Christians died. And so the historians ask the question, why? What's going on? Why did the Christians stay in the cities? And the answer is because of what we've been looking at today, because of the resurrection. The Christians believe that whatever happened to them in the short term, they knew that the story of the world would end well. Because of Jesus, they too would one day receive resurrected bodies. They would live in a renewed creation. And so they knew that the worst that death could do to them was just bring that hope a bit closer. In John Lennon's song, Imagine, that my children were singing to me yesterday, Lennon tells us to imagine all the people living for today. And it's a very romantic picture and a beautiful tune. But I want to suggest we don't really have to imagine it. We can see it. We can see it with the pagans in the Roman Empire, and it is not pretty. If today is all we've got, well, why on earth should I give away what I have? Why on earth should I sacrifice for another person? It would be illogical to do that. If people live for today, it is very, very ugly. If this world is all there is, then someone might live sacrificially. And thankfully, a lot of non-Christians are very kind and sacrificial. But it will be in spite of their beliefs, not because of them. Because, of course, the Christian hope, the resurrection, frees us to live sacrificially and radically in this world. We don't have to visit every beauty spot in the world. We don't have to have every possible experience on offer. We don't have to spend our lives trying to pursue the perfect house, the perfect body, the perfect family, the perfect life in the country, as if this life is all there is. No, we're freed from that. And instead, we can start to live as we were created to live sacrificially for others. And I have to say, it really is wonderful when we see this. And I see it in all kinds of ways in this congregation, this kind of dynamic. Lots of examples of practical care people show one another, often making personal sacrifices. And why? Well, it's because you guys know that this world is not all there is, and so you can pour yourself out for others. There's an irony, of course, here. It's often been argued that offering people hope will only demotivate them. Perhaps you've heard that, you know, Karl Marx argued if you tell people there's an afterlife, they'll never be motivated to improve this life. And of course, actually, the reality is exactly the opposite. Biblical hope always is productive. C.S. Lewis said, if you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. And he's thinking there of folk like Lord Shaftesbury or William Wilberforce or Elizabeth Fry. The resurrection enables us to live sacrificially and compassionately in this world. And finally, before we close, the final practical difference that belief in resurrection makes is that we can live hopefully. So discovering that Jesus really has been raised and that the story of the world really will end well for those who are joined to Jesus, you may have discovered it doesn't fix every problem in our lives. I imagine that's not a surprise to lots of us. In fact, Jesus has told his disciples that they should expect things to get worse when they follow him. For example, in chapter 15, they were told that they should expect persecution. And yet, he's also told them, and this was in chapter 16, that despite the fact that in the world they will have trouble, And we can echo, amen that. We know that's true. He also told them that in him, they will have peace. He's told his disciples that they can live calmly, they can live hopefully through all kinds of trials in their lives. I was chatting last Sunday to Arlene Ellis after the service and about how she's been enjoying the books of Joni Erickson Tada. And it reminded me of what a brilliant example Joni is on this whole topic of the difference that the resurrection hope makes in a person's life. If you haven't heard of her, this is Joni. She's a woman who was in an accident when she was 17. And since then, she's been quadriplegic. She's been paralyzed from the neck down. And she writes very movingly about how the resurrection of Jesus has transformed her outlook. And she says this. I, with shriveled, bent fingers, atrophied muscles, gnarled knees, and no feeling from the shoulders down, will one day have a new body, light, bright, and clothed in righteousness, powerful and dazzling. Can you imagine the hope that Jesus' resurrection gives someone who is spinal cord injured like me? Now, I don't know what particular challenges you might be facing this week. Perhaps there's a situation in your life which causes you to ask, well, is there any hope? Will the story of the world end well? What I do know is that Jesus' resurrection changes everything. For those who will put their trust in Jesus, if we are lonely now, in the new creation, when Jesus returns, we will have perfect love. If we are empty now, in the new creation, we will be fully satisfied. One writer puts it like this: ordinary life is going to be redeemed. Food and work and chairs by the fire and hugs and dancing and mountains. Jesus' resurrection declares that everything is going to be redeemed and made perfect. And that is what is in store for us. And he continues, if you know that this is not the only world, the only body, the only life you're ever going to have, that you will someday have a perfect life, a real concrete life, then you're free. You're free from ultimate anxieties in this life. You can face the worst things in this world, even real sufferings, with joy and hope. So the message of this passage is that we can be encouraged. Jesus has been raised. The story of the world will end well. And therefore we can live sacrificially and hopefully as we live waiting for that great day. I'm going to leave a moment's quiet and we can come in the quietness before the Lord and try and think about what we've take on board and put into practice what we've been hearing, and then we'll have our prayers from Neve.